The second reading comes from the children's book, The Van Gogh Cafe, from which the sermon this morning gets its title. I want to tell you a little bit about The Van Gogh Cafe before I do the reading. The Van Gogh Cafe sits in the middle of Kansas. And long before it was a cafe, it used to be an old vaudeville theater. And because of its history as a vaudeville theater, the people who go to the cafe believe that the magic that was once a part of the theater occasionally reappears and shows itself. This is the story of one of those magical reappearances. This is the story of the possum. Kansas is not what you would call picturesque. It is flat. So flat it could make some people a little crazy. People who need a hill now and then to keep their balance. But in Kansas, at least things get noticed. The flatness makes everything count, and not one thing slips by. And that is why if a possum were going to choose to hang upside down somewhere, Kansas would be a good choice. People would notice. And if the possum chose to hang upside down in the front window of the Van Gogh Cafe in Flowers, Kansas, well, then everyone would start talking about magic. And that would be good for the possum, too. The Van Gogh Cafe is owned by a young man named Mark and his daughter, Clara. Clara is another reason for all of the magic at the cafe. She is 10 and believes anything might happen. Mark and Clara open the cafe every morning at 6, except on Sundays, when they sleep until 10. Clara takes breakfast orders for Mark, who is the cook, for half an hour on school mornings before going across the street to their apartment to get ready for school. Clara likes taking orders first thing in the morning because everyone is sleepy and sweet and all they want in the world is a cup of coffee, please. Clara thinks that morning is the kindest time of day. Now, most of the people who come to the Van Gogh Cafe are Flowers people. They know each other. Hi, Ray. Hello, Roy. But sometimes someone is new. For Flowers sits near Interstate 70, which people take when they're escaping from an old life in the East to a new life in the West or the other way around. Clara has met many people between 6 and 6:30 on their way to something new. But she has not met a possum until today. Today is Saturday. She's working a couple of extra hours for her father. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly there's a possum hanging upside down in the tree right in front of the window, right on Main Street. Clara sees it first. Look! There's a possum. Coffee cups go down, heads turn. Outside, the little gray possum enjoys being noticed. It scratches its nose and blinks its eyes back at all of the faces. Now, no one sitting down can say hello to a possum, so everyone in the cafe gets up, and they go and stand in front of the window. Now, this is the magic of the Van Gogh Cafe. Not one person says, "Amazing, a possum hanging upside down on Main Street." No, they're not all surprised, because they, like Clara, have come to believe that anything might happen. Because they've been having breakfast at the Van Gogh Cafe all of their lives. What they do say is, "Hi." Some of them wave. Roy asks Ray what possums eat. And with their typical curiosity about every new face in town, they all say, "Wonder where he's from." Well, it's hard to know a possum's story before he does something magical, but once he does, there's story and more to tell. One of the first stories is the possum starts coming back to the Van Gogh Cafe. 8 o'clock in the morning, every day, he's up in that tree. But that's a small story. The possum begins to attract people, and this is a bigger story. It's a bigger story because he attracts people. People who haven't been getting along. Best friends who had a fight the day before. Today they're standing on the sidewalk next to the possum. The possum is hanging upside down and blinking. The two friends are talking. And suddenly, they've got their arms around each other and they're heading into the cafe for some pie. A young husband and wife, the day before they're yelling in their front yard. The next day they're kissing beside the possum. Two neighbors, the day before they're arguing about loud music. The next day the possum is watching them shake hands. The story becomes even bigger when people start bringing food outside of the Van Gogh Cafe. Food for the possum. Half an English muffin here, two oven fried potatoes there, a cup of milk. Can't help themselves. They want to give it some food. possum isn't hungry. But a stray dog from the other side of town is, and she starts stopping by for breakfast. So does a thin cat and her new baby kittens, a shy small mouse, several sparrows, even a deer. And this goes on for a while until the biggest story happens. A story that will enter quietly into the walls of the Van Gogh Cafe and become part of its magic. For a man whose wife has died is passing through Flowers, Kansas one morning on his way to something new. He is sad. He really isn't sure where he's going. But passing the Van Gogh Cafe, he sees the possum. He sees the possum, and he sees all the hungry animals standing beneath it, eating the scraps of muffins and potatoes. And the man sees something else there too. Something no one else has seen until now. And because of what he sees, he turns his car around and he drives back to where he belongs, back to his farm. A farm which he will turn into a home for stray animals who will come to him and help take away some of his loneliness. Since that day, the possum at the Van Gogh Cafe has disappeared. One minute it was there, the next minute it wasn't. But the customers, they still bring out food in case anyone hungry happens by. There's always a new stray dog, a new thin cat, sparrows. Clara is not surprised the possum has gone away. Things are always changing at the Van Gogh Cafe. Something new is sure to happen soon. Perhaps when the silent movie star arrives. I begin the sermon this morning with a story from my own life, from when I was teaching elementary school in Kentucky over 25 years ago. I was unpacking children's books at the time. My principal, Jay Jordan, walked into my classroom and he closed the door. He surveyed my room and he shook his head. Definitely a Keith Cron fourth grade classroom. A few books here, a few chairs there, two bulletin boards scattered all over the floor. My desk was already swamped with papers. And the school year wouldn't start for 2 days yet. We looked at each other and I knew I was at the OK Corral. I wasn't sure what I was about to be shot for, but I knew something was up. Perhaps you've seen the face and the fidgeting of a 9-year-old child who lied to you 20 minutes before about having to use the restroom but now really needs to go. My principal looks somewhat less composed than that. He asked me if I'd gotten his message from the day before, if I wanted to talk to him about something. I told him I had. Silence. More fidgeting. Began to have an inkling of what this conversation was going to be about. I'm glad we're on your turf, Jay said. He looked at me for a minute and I nodded. Silence. Jay took a breath. You know that Tristan Burke is no longer on your class list. I nodded again. His mother made me take him out of your class. Jay looked down and then back up. I nodded again. Tristan's mother was president of the PTA that year. I only vaguely knew who Tristan was, and the only thing I knew about him was that he was the most effeminate boy I'd encountered in 5 years of teaching. His mother made me take him out of your class because she says she knows you're a homosexual. I don't know how she knows it, but she knows it. They looked at me, and I looked at him. And I could see the wheels in his head. I would wonder later if he could see the wheels spinning in mine. Fortunately and sadly, I'd prepared for this moment. I had no doubts it would come at some point. Years of thinking about it had almost kept me from going into teaching, but the desire to teach had won out. I knew to say nothing. I knew to wait to be asked, and then I would answer yes. Only then. I raised my eyebrows back at him. Bore silence. Part of me was hoping that he would ask, that I would be given an opportunity to tell him, that I could finally tell my story. He didn't ask. He broke the silence. "This is ridiculous," he said. "You're not the type of person to harm children." We looked at each other and I nodded quietly, realizing the support that I was getting from him. It was a bittersweet moment for both of us. Jay finally mumbled, "I shouldn't have pulled him out of your class." "She would have made your year horrible," I said. "Mine too, for that matter." "It's okay." Jay nodded quietly back at me. "We did reading groups today," I said. "Tristan will be in my class for reading. It's an hour each day." Jay was firmer now. "She'll get my backing. You'll get my backing. She'll just have to deal with it. There's another parent concerned too. I'll deal with him as well." "We won't talk about this ever again." Jay surveyed my room. "Now get this room cleaned up. I don't know how you're going to be ready to start teaching in 2 days. He spun on his heels and he turned toward the door. He opened it and he turned back to me. "Glad we did this on your turf," he repeated. He looked at me one last time, tried to smile, and left, closing the door behind him. For the next 4 years, I never heard any of those complaints again. Tristan and I got along famously. I invited his mother to come into reading class to help out when she could, and she did. And she and I laughed a lot together that year. From me, she learned all about the fine art of teasing children. And probably a few other things. It occurs to me I should tell you why I'm here, why I'm now a Unitarian Universalist minister, direct the transitions office for our Unitarian Universalist Association, and am not teaching elementary school anymore. I left teaching elementary school because I was afraid. Now, it's more than being afraid of being found out and fired for being a known homosexual, though that was certainly a part of it. The longer I stuck around in Lexington, Kentucky, the greater the odds were that my private life would become public knowledge. My parents, who've not used the words gay or homosexual in the 30 years I've been out to them, are a part of this story too. My father was an elementary school principal in the same school system I taught in. My mother taught first grade at a neighboring school as well. I never had the opportunity of thinking of fighting this battle alone. And my folks had given me a lifetime of modeling to know how to overprotect people. I knew any public battle I chose to engage in there would also have included them. I lived four lives when I lived in Lexington, Kentucky. I lived a work life where I loved the work of teaching elementary school. I lived a family life where I had dinner with my folks once a week, visited my grandmother a lot, and overspent on my relatives at Christmas. I lived a gay life where I hung out with my friends, led a support group, and played volleyball. I lived a religious life where I sat on nearly every committee of my home Unitarian Universalist congregation. I moved on to district and denominational work beyond that. I even managed to see some overlapping. Certainly my work life and my family life overlap some. And as I came out in my congregation, my gay life and my religious life began to merge. I worked very hard at making my congregation a place that would be welcoming for bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender people. I worked very hard to bring bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender people into our congregation. And it happened. It happened, in part, because I and others started telling our stories in church. I was able to tell the story of having a crush on Mr. Gardner, my high school drama teacher, and as a 17-year-old working up the courage to tell him about that crush. I was able to tell the story of being raised in a very Southern Baptist church and having my Anita Bryant-type Sunday school teacher ask me if I agreed with her that homosexuals were sick people. I was able to tell the story of coming out to my own parents and having my father ask me if I was going to molest children while my mother cried. I was able to tell the story of meeting a Unitarian Universalist minister one night in a gay bar, and that's where I first learned about Unitarian Universalism. I was becoming aware that not only could I be 11 and 10 and 9 and 8 and 7 and 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1, but I could talk about them as well. You see, my real fear is not that someone like my principal would ask me if I was gay, but ask me my story. My real fear is that I would never get to tell it. This is what the radical right wants, to control our society so only certain approved stories can be told. This is why the work that you all have done around Welcoming Congregation, around the Black Lives Matter banner, the work we did yesterday in the Beyond Categorical Thinking workshop, the work of letting people not only have their story, but their stories, is so vitally important. I was afraid that I would never get to have a life. I was afraid that I would always have four of them. My fear is not that my private life would become public knowledge. My fear is either that it never would or would happen only on someone else's terms. When I hear people say they want to make sure they have a private life and a public life, I wonder, do they really want two lives? Categories for human beings really are a bad idea, and I think I learned that during my conversation with my principal. As an aside, I do understand that people are talking about control and choice. When they make the point about wanting to have a private life, I'm all for that. I just believe, however, as human beings, we do better when we only have one life to juggle. It's more than enough to do. So it was after this conversation with my principal that I began to know that I needed to make a change. I looked around me and I became sadly aware of the number of people I knew who were also living more than one life at a time. There was my good friend and teaching colleague across the hallway who had at one time been married to a man who had a sexual addiction for children, but she felt like she could never talk about this with anyone. My own father who tries to pretend that he never had a father and never talks about him. My friend Steve, who quit playing the piano because he became a librarian. I still haven't figured that one out. My friend Sandra, who told no one about her live-in boyfriend, Dick. All of these people and so many more who never got to be 11. It was hardest for me to see in the children I taught. Children who came to school and then had to go home and cook and clean for younger brothers and sisters. Children who knew they could not fail. Children who would go home to wars, children whom would have to parent their parents. And by the time they were 9 years old, they already knew they had to keep these lives quiet. Religious educator Maria Harris talks about implicit education, what we teach without ever actually saying it out loud. I knew I was implicitly teaching my students to have more than one life. There had to be a better way. I looked at how I might make it a better way, and I learned of cities that had non-discrimination policies for teachers, but back then, at that time, I didn't trust that those were real. I looked at the amount of work I had to do, and I thought about the fact that I often spent more time documenting what I taught, how I taught it, and who was there to hear it, than I did get to teach some days. So I decided to look elsewhere. The person I saw doing the most teaching was my minister and the other Unitarian Universalist ministers I knew. And they didn't have to fill out report cards either. I remember Jesus was a teacher in many ways. Rabbis consider themselves to be teachers. And I watched the Unitarian Universalist ministers I knew, and I watched the way they taught people around them. Often by telling stories. Often their own stories. At the same time, I'd begun leading homophobia workshops in Unitarian Universalist congregations. Now, not how to have more of it, but how to have less. And I learned quickly three things about teaching adults. One, they don't necessarily have longer attention spans than children. They just do a better job of faking. Usually engaging people on an emotional level increases their attentiveness. Two, adult learning is as much about unlearning as it is about learning. Three, the product isn't nearly as important as the process. So how would you teach someone to be less homophobic, less racist, less sexist, less ableist? Well, explicitly, you're teaching them about that oppression. Implicitly, you're teaching them about vulnerability. Now that's where the possum shows up. That's where the magic happens. Because as people let themselves become more vulnerable, they then become stronger and less homophobic, less racist, less sexist, less ableist. I did this through telling stories. Sometimes my own stories. And I was blessed with the stories of others. I saw the possibility for having one life. A friend of mine from seminary and I were talking one day, and she said you could learn a fair amount about a person by asking them these four questions. One, when did you stop singing? Two, when did you stop dancing? Three, when did you stop playing? Four, when did you stop telling your story? For the record, I stopped singing in third grade when Mrs. Rice said I shouldn't sing anymore. Well, I'll still hum to myself if I think people aren't looking. I still go dancing, I still play. And as I told my friend Marianne, it's more a matter of when I started telling my story than when I stopped. I stopped telling my story at 14. It would be 10 years before I started telling some of my stories again. It's only since I've become a Unitarian Universalist minister that I've not had to figure out what story I could tell where. Like the story of the possum, one story leads to another. And when we hear our story in someone else's story, well, that's the magic. That's when we encounter mystery. What are your stories? Have you stopped telling them? You only tell them in certain places, certain lives. How well do you know the stories of those around you? The stories in this room, your stories, are magical. I hope you are not afraid to tell them. They are your life, and they let you be fully 11, or whatever age you are. Final story also from the Van Gogh Cafe, and then I will close. This is the story of the Silent Star. It is winter in the cafe. Mark is in the back cooking, though the restaurant is empty. Clara's putting napkins into the napkin holders when a man walks in. He is tall, slender, and moves like water. He is strikingly handsome and a fabulous dresser. Black cloak, black cashmere scarf, black wool gloves, black cane. His white hair sets it off perfectly. He must be 90. Clara takes his order. Tea plain. Boiled egg, please. Thank you. Clara thinks there is something romantic about him. After his food is served, Mark comes out of the kitchen looking for his watch. He looks around and he sees the man. Mark stops what he is doing and he stares. He stares because he knows who the elegant man in the cafe is. He is a star. Clara doesn't know, of course. She's watched the old films with her father, but except for Chaplin, doesn't know their names, only their movements. And perhaps it is the way that the elegant man has moved through the cafe that reminds her of something that she has seen before, reminds everyone. But none can quite place the memory. The breakfast hours pass and people come and go to work, to the mall at the edge of town, back home. But the elegant man stays on. He's hardly touched his egg. His teacup is still half full. And the door of the Van Gogh Cafe opens and closes. Opens and closes. Yet he stays on looking. Looking out the window. Finally, Mark cannot help himself. When there is no one left in the cafe except for the silent star, Mark walks over to his table. Clara, who is curious, shyly follows. Mark offers his hand and the man gracefully takes it. They shake. "I love your work," Mark says softly. I love it. I love all of your films. Clara's eyes are wide. She has not known until now that a star is in her cafe, and the old man blushes and smiles. "Thank you," he says. There is an awkward moment, then graciously he offers Mark and Clara the two empty chairs at his table. Happily they sit. Mark and the silent star talk about the old films as Clara listens. There is an innocence in her father's face that she has not seen before. He is like a boy. And the silent star seems pleased, quietly thrilled, to talk of his work with someone who knows it so well. To finally tell his story. He laughs and sighs and even trembles slightly, reliving it all. There is a moment when each is silent, catching a breath. "Why, sir, are you at the Van Gogh Cafe?" Mark gently asks. The old man seems glad someone has asked, and he reaches into his coat, and he pulls forth an old photograph. He hands it first to Clara, and then to Mark. It is of a beautiful young man in a top hat and waistcoat, standing before an old theater. Mark looks carefully at the building in the picture. Is this? "Yes," replies the silent star. "The building is the Van Gogh Cafe in 1923, when it was still a theater. He and I did some shows here together. The summer we met." The silent star smiles and puts the photograph back into his coat. Today, I am waiting for him." Clara's heart is pounding. She feels like she herself is in a movie. Each gesture the man makes, each word the man speaks, is so beautiful to her. She knows the cafe remembers this man. She can feel it drawing into him, reaching for this man who's been a part of the first magic on the stage of the old theater. Oddly, not one person has walked into the cafe to break this spell. Mark offers the star a fresh cup of tea and a piece of apple pie, which are gratefully accepted. Then Mark and Clara leave the old man to his waiting. The lunch hours come and go, and then the dinner hours. The silent star waits. Occasionally, Mark or Clara offer him something, but he politely declines. And they find themselves watching the door, watching the window, waiting. Waiting for a beautiful man in a top hat and waistcoat. Finally, it is time to close, and still the old man is waiting. He seems very tired now, tired but unworried. He asks Mark if he might sit by the window a little longer. "Of course," says Mark. So he offers his guest room to the man, offers to take him home for the evening, and to return him to the table by the window the next day. But the man is certain that his friend is coming very soon. "Very soon," he says. So Mark takes Clara home and returns to the cafe a few hours later to check on the old man. At first, he thinks the man is asleep. And then he realizes that the man has died. In the old man's hand, Mark finds a newspaper clipping that is cracked and yellow. The clipping shows the face of the beautiful young man in the top hat and waistcoat. It reports that he was drowned in 1936. And in the old man's other hand is the same photograph that Mark and Claire were shown. Now the photograph has changed. The beautiful young man is gone, and there's only a soft, empty light where he was standing. Mark and Claire keep the newspaper clipping and the picture inside a small box near the cash register. And every so often, when things are quiet, they pull these out and they look at them again. They each think how perfect it is that the silent star has died, where he found his true love, that he came back to the Van Gogh Cafe, and he waited for his friend to take him home. Whatever forces are against you, whatever pain and suffering is yours, whatever joy you have, whatever your story is, my wish for you is that you share your story whenever and wherever you choose. Whether you are 11 or 90 or somewhere in between. Sing, dance, play, tell your stories. Listen to the stories of others. Live your one life and feel its magic.